Resolving Conflict Through Faith. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. We're always live at 9. You can subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can also watch clips from the show at our partner, TVJax.com. And just ahead, nationally respected faith leaders from three major faiths are here to continue a conversation they started yesterday at the University of North Florida. Join our conversation now at 549-2937. Also ahead this morning, the man behind the First Coast's Mellow Mushroom and Burrito Gallery will speak with entrepreneur John Valentino in today's First Coast Success. Plus, free healthcare for Jacksonville's uninsured, a preview of a special event this weekend, all of that and sports with Cole Pepper. That's ahead today on First Coast Connect. But first, this hour, guests representing three faiths are here to share their experience on a panel discussion yesterday at UNF. It was called Peace in the Middle East, Inspiring Voices and Stories. The event, moderated by our own Melissa Ross, was sold out. But here to share with all of us who couldn't attend are Rabbi Daniil Hartman, president of the New York and Jerusalem-based Shalom Hartman Institute. Welcome to First Coast Connect, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Good morning. Also here is Imam Abdullah Antepli, Chief Representative of Muslim Affairs and former chaplain at Duke University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the Reverend Dr. Molly Marshall, President and Professor of Theology and Spiritual Formation at Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And to our callers, what are your questions for our guests this morning about peace in the Middle East and the role faith communities can play in achieving it? Share your thoughts now at 549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Now, the Middle East is a large area encompassing many nations with very complicated histories. I want to start with you, Rabbi Hartman, specifically talking about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version of why we don't have peace there today?
We don't have peace because we have too good a memory. Mm-hmm. We're playing out 2,000-year-old ideologies and hatreds. Sometimes faith has to help you forget.
Okay.
So that you could actually look forward. And I feel that we're stuck in a 2,000-year-old story, and we have to begin to open up. We have to start thinking about what our story should be tomorrow.
And do you believe faith is capable of helping us forget?
It can. And sometimes it can't. That's the tragedy of faith, that so often it underachieves. It ought to create humility. It ought to create an individual who, because you believe in God, see all of God's creations who are created in the image of God as your morally significant others. But all too often, faith makes you certain. Faith makes you just see yourself. Faith makes you blind to others. So could faith be the solution? In the Middle East, it has to be part of the solution, but it is also undoubtedly part of the problem.
Dr. Marshall, you wrote on your blog recently that there will be no peace in the world without peace among religions. What does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, let me give credit to Hans Küng, the great theologian who wrote that, although I would like to claim it. I believe that the internal work that people of faith must do allows them to be receptive then to the religious other. And I think because globalization and world religions are so closely intertwined that world religions can be a force for good if we would plumb the best of our traditions and be receptive to the best of our neighbors' traditions. It's hard work. It's vulnerable work. Mm-hmm. And we are at risk somewhat on the more conservative flanks of our own respective traditions when we do that. But I think it is the right work for us to do at this point.
Now, the panel discussion yesterday was about peace in the Middle East. That's a topic that might cause a fight at a family dinner table, right? But you three managed to have a civil discussion about this, yes? What did you find, Imam, what did you find that you all agreed on yesterday?
I think we all agreed on the role of religion as a peacemaker, the role of religion as a source which will help us to have healthy forgetting. And one of the issues is also there is no peace in the Middle East because everybody is wanting an ultimate justice for their own story.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimate and absolute justice is the biggest injustice. If justice, the sense of justice, is not accompanied with forgiveness, with mercy and compassion, in the name of justice and just, you can do all sorts of injustices and unfairness. And there is a role we can draft religion, that we can draft and utilize certain forces within religion. Don't get me wrong, religion can be a force of violence and destruction and death and pretty much what we see in the Middle East and elsewhere today. But religion can also do so much good if it is utilized and drafted in the right direction. That's what we agree.
Now, if you're listening right now and you have questions for our panelists, call right now 549-2937. Going to the phones now, we have Paul calling from Orange Park. Good morning, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes. I am reading a book that compares passages in the Surah with passages in the Bible, and I thought it was very interesting to see just how many similarities there were. Of course, anybody who studied either of these books knows that Ishmael was the firstborn son of Abraham. So he would, by traditional standards, be the inheritor of Abraham's estate, or at least a large portion of it. And so, yeah, I can understand why the 12 nations that have come out of Ishmael's descendants, feel very strongly about having the territory that Israel occupies, even though it's a very small piece of land compared to the amount of land held by the Israelis. But there's a couple examples here. I'm reading a book about the last four. It cites from the Quran about Mary, quote, this is Surah 19, verse 20, I guess you would say. It says, she said, how shall I have a son seeing a man hath not touched me, and I'm no harlot. And, of course, that's mirrored in the Bible. And then in Surah 19, 33 and 34, it refers to the resurrection of Jesus.
Paul, thank you. Thank you for your call. To our panelists here today, can you speak to the similarities between the three religions we have represented in this room? Thank you for your call again, Paul. Imam.
The similarities are enormous. Between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, in the Duke Divinity School, pretty much what I teach, theological, more so ethical and moral similarities. Both religions claim to come from a monotheistic message and divine revelation of God. And therefore, they have so many scriptural, prophetic similarities. And we can talk about this, but ultimately, our attempt to invest in our similarities should not undermine our differences. Our differences are as important, if not more important. Our ability to reconcile and model and exemplify a peaceful coexistence is not depending on solely on the similarities,
mm-hmm.
but our ability to understand, appreciate, and even more so celebrate our differences. Because ultimately what makes us who we are is not our similarities, but our unique, distinct, particularistic elements, which are as a result of millennium-long wisdoms, accumulated wisdom in our faith traditions. Any conversation about our similarities should accompany with our differences as well.
Let me speak about a couple of things that I've learned from the traditions that you all participate in. From Islam, Imam, I've learned so much about the discipline of prayer and the seriousness with which that actually shapes the rhythms of one's life. And as a Christian, I admire that and seek to emulate dimensions of that. Rabbi, I've learned so much about a good argument with God from the tradition of Judaism and its close attention to text, always looking at interrogating texts, and the sense of intimacy with the divine that can foster a kind of ongoing interrogation of a very difficult and challenging tradition. And as a Christian who shares roots with your traditions, I'm very, very grateful to have learned from you all.
See, that's what you're seeing modeled here is the example of where interfaith dialogue or learning should go. Hmm. In the past, we thought that the way we would get together is to find the similarities between us. We're all more or less the same, and therefore we could love you, because really loving you is loving me, because you're just so much like me that I just have to move a little bit, and then it's an extension of self-love, and I include someone else in that self. Where we are now is that we are at a moment where we could recognize, as Abdullah said, that our differences and the interest in those differences is that I want to learn from you. I want to learn from the Christian tradition. Here it is, we have three traditions who for thousands of years have been trying to figure out what God wants from us and how do we transform a life with God into a life of goodness. And the experiences that each one of us has could profoundly enrich each one of our traditions. So the next decade of interfaith conversation is no longer about let's sit together and talk about the verses we share, but what could I learn from you and how could my life of faith be enhanced because I've met you, because I hear you. I think it was Christel Stendhal who spoke about holy envy, to be wholly envious of each other and to learn from that.
You hinted earlier that it might be difficult to convince some of the, I believe, Dr. Marshall, you said more conservative branches in your religions of the value of looking to other religions. Have you experienced that, and how did you overcome it?
I've experienced that for the last 40 years as I have sought to ask the question of my own tradition, of our missionary notion that somehow all the world should share the faith of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And the various ways in which by sword, colonization, and other untoward methods we have sought to compel the faith of others. I've interrogated that because I don't see that in God's more expansive, merciful vision of the world. And it also is it's a horrible form of spiritual arrogance to presume that your tradition holds all the truth and the others do not. So it's been a theological project for me for many, many years to try to discern the ways of God at work in the varied traditions of the world. And so I've made some movement as an old school marm who's been teaching students for a long time. And in the way our seminary seeks to posture cultivating respect for the lived religion of others. That's core value for us. And I think that makes that opens up a transformational horizon.
I want to go now to an email from a listener. It says, to Molly Marshall, wish I had known earlier you were in town. Greetings from a former student, Janelle Ganey. Oh,
that's wonderful.
Speaking of your teaching. And now let's go to the phones again. Ed is calling from I-295. Good morning, Ed. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great panel. Thank you to all everybody in the panel. This is, I think, one of the concerns that people have regarding the religions and the ancient old texts and so on. All the religions, whether it's Hindu, Buddhist, Islam, or Christians, or Jewish, base their faith on many ancient old books that were written, which we now, to our modern sensibilities, find out some of the teachings there apprehensible, but that's not the problem. The problem is that, as an example, nobody seems to practice those ancient we find apprehensible, stoning people or so on, except for, unfortunately, right now, the Islam world. This is sort of like, to me, like somebody, 10,000 people who read Dracula, and one guy is the one that decides to buy you the dick. That's the guy you need to worry about. It's not reading the book. It's acting on the book, on the bad part of the books. And I wanted to see what your panel think about that.
All right. Thank you for the comment, Ed. And again, if you have a question or comment for our panel, the number is 549-2937. We're looking over at Imam Abdul.
Well, I highly encourage our wonderful participant to diversify his sources of information about the notion that he talked that only Muslims are acting on those archaic, barbaric, primitive practices and nobody else is taking the barbaric and primitive and archaic elements in their texts seriously. Instead of citing all those stuff, maybe my Christian and Jewish colleagues here can help me. But he's absolutely right that there are parts of the Muslim world as a result of decades-long death and destruction and civilizational decline and deterioration, as a result of having failed states economically, socially, politically, when a society fails so deeply, it reveals the worst of any aspect of them. It reveals the worst of their culture. It reveals the worst of their whatever identities, and including it reveals the worst of their religion as well. I think those primitive, archaic practices which exist in the name of Islam, which is unacceptable, which has never been the part of mainstream Islam, never, which has never been the common practice in the last 1,400 years, should be understood within the context, the bigger context. It's not just because people take religion so literally, but it's because that part of the world has gone through so much decline and deterioration for so long that those practices emerging.
And we're talking about the rise of the Islamic State or the group called ISIS. Rabbi?
There is no such thing as a moral religion. There's only moral interpreters of religion. We inherit sacred scripture and the serious challenge and responsibility we have. Just like we must improve our world, we get the raw material of a world, and we were created in God's image to rule it, master it, and improve it. We have a similar responsibility with our holy scriptures. We have responsibility to improve them, to emphasize that which is a force for good, and to fight against that which is not. And connecting back to the prior question, the fundamentalists in all of our religions make a career in those chapters that the devil quotes, because as Shakespeare taught us, the devil quotes scriptures, the devil doesn't misquote them. That's where they live. And they're not going to listen to us. We're not going to defeat the fundamentalists head on. But we can access the majority of people who through silence and through passivity are allowing a minority to define and to determine the public face and the future of our religious traditions. It's not about defeating fundamentalists. It's about getting the passive people of faith to recognize that they have to stand up, open up their windows, and to scream, I've had it and I'm not going to take it anymore. When we do that, then the fundamentalists will still exist, but their power will be significantly diminished.
Dr. Marshall.
And as a Christian who has experienced so often how people read selectively, mm-hmm. and they use certain abomination texts selectively, I find that we have to interrogate how we read, lest our reading of Holy Scripture become simply an echo of what we thought already. Mm-hmm. And it does not interrogate us as really a sacred text should.
Now going to the phones, Cindy in St. Augustine is on the line. Good morning, Cindy.
Hi. I grew up Catholic. I became a pagan in my teens. I'm actually an anthropologist. I studied religion heavily in college. And in all my studies, in my own seeking religion and through my college studies, there was a lot of talk about these universal values that you all have been talking about. And it's not just the major religions. There are stories similar to Jonah and the whale in Yucatan ancient religions. And a lot of people will try and say that this is pointing towards some underlying universal truth in religion, that one of them is right. But what it really speaks to, from my studies I've seen, is that there are underlying truths and questions that we hold as a species, the things that we need answered that come through spirituality. And I think that's where we really need to look for the similarities of what are we trying to ask for as a human race? What do we need answered to come together like that?
All right. Thank you for the call, Cindy. That raises the question, how can people who don't identify with any faith be part of the solution? Rabbi?
One of the jobs of people who don't identify with a faith is to be critics of faith. And people of faith have to not only not be frightened by that criticism, but to embrace it. We are always better when there is a check and balance in our lives. People of faith and people who are living profound moral lives outside of a system of faith together have to engage with each other and to challenge each other and move ourselves forward. The greatest danger of religious life is that it both commands the good and defines the good. And in so doing creates an insulated story which moves without any breaks. So people outside of faith have a profound responsibility or a gift to bear witness to the moral voice that they hear. And our responsibility is to listen very, very carefully.
All right.
I think our religion suffered long about having monopoly in so many homogeneous societies and cultures. The people of no faith or people being spiritual but not members of any organized religion is providing a great opportunity for people of faith to create an open market of ideas and where we are going to be able to struggle further to refine our ethical moral teachings to see if you don't sign the membership form, do you still have something important and meaningful to say? Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful challenge to have.
And to her point, her concern about there being a common longing and a sense of self-contradiction that humans all experience because we know that we long for peace, for justice, for self-actualization, for communities of value, and we fail. But she is pointing to an anthropological reality or a datum of how a person is constructed with a longing that exceeds his or her grasp. Mm. And so that does point and raise questions of faith as well as commonality of human experience.
Going now to the phones, Conrad calling from the beaches. Good morning, Conrad. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to say that I hope you all will embrace my thoughts, but frankly, I consider myself an agnostic, and I find that most of the problems in the world seem to stem from religious ferocity by various people, among of whom I would suspect you are. I don't mean to be insulting, but I just find that these ultra-religious people are generally the most hypocritical and, frankly, closed-minded people I've ever met. I've been an agnostic slash atheist for years, frankly, and I find the people of that negative faith, if you want to call it that, generally are much more open-minded and willing to accept people of other religions and other thoughts. So having said that, I frankly find this program kind of peculiar for WJCT. As a sustainer, I've got to rethink my position with WJCT. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you for your call, Conrad. Rabbi.
My challenge to Conrad is to practice the ideology that he's professing.
What do you mean by that?
He seemed to be accusing us of closed-mindedness, judgmentalism, narrow-mindedness. One of the things that we found is that both, you know, if you exit the 20th century, if you have some memory of the 20th century, it seems that secular society is capable of hurting people too, in the name of various isms. The challenge of all of us is whether you are a person of faith or not a person of faith, is to what extent you recognize that you as a human being cannot contain the whole truth. That could grow profoundly out of your humanity. And to understand that I am a mere human and as a result certainty transcends me, or can grow in the midst of your conversation with God in which you recognize that you're not God and that the greatest idolatry that a system of faith and a system of secularism could produce is the idolatry of humankind. And idolatry of humankind produces people who are certain. And when you're certain, you judge. When you're certain, you kill. When you're certain, you pull away your money. When you're certain, you... Life is so, so clear. And unfortunately, life is not clear. And what we need is is the gentleness, the kindness, and the humility which could grow both from your humanity and from your life with God.
Right.
Well said. And I grew up in Turkey in a very secular environment, but I have been in the receiving end of secular intolerance, secular oppression and persecution. And the 20th century genocides, Holocaust, often has been committed, the perishing of millions of lives, as Rabbi Hartman said, in the name of certain secular, non-religious isms.
And I would argue that the various religions offer significant and compelling visions of religious flourishing that need to be a part of the whole public discourse.
But having said that, of course, the evil things, horrific things being done in the name of religion, I'm not taking the religious people or religions or religiosity, evil religiosity, out of the hook either. But one has to be balanced. Ultimately, violence is not something religion produced. Violence is a human thing. And religion can play a role in feeding that evil element in humanity or taming it, controlling it.
All right. On that note, our guests this morning participated in a panel discussion yesterday on peace in the Middle East, hosted by the University of North Florida Interfaith Center and the Atlantic Institute of Jacksonville. Thank you so much to Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman, president of the New York and Jerusalem-based Shalom Hartman Institute, Imam Dr. Abdullah Antepli, chief representative of Muslim Affairs at Duke University, and the Reverend Dr. Molly T. Marshall, president and professor of theology and spiritual formation at Central Baptist Theological Seminary. Thank you so much. And much more is still ahead on our show this morning. Later in the hour, sports with Cole Pepper. And First Coast Success profiles restaurateur John Valentino. But up next, free healthcare screenings and more at the first ever Medical Mission at Home event from St. Vincent's. Back in a moment with more First Coast Connect.
She's been called a crook and a con artist.
She was not the kind of person I would trust alone with a child.
But lots of people did trust her. And because she calls herself a Christian, no one can shut her down.
The law is unfortunate. It allows these type of daycares to open up without any restriction.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Two giant chemical companies merge, but who's responsible for what's left behind?
Everybody has kind of considered the DuPont to Dow acquisitions to be a way of either escaping from the corporate responsibility or reinforcing themselves for the liabilities that are out there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. When big business gets very personal, that's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
As a 10-year-old boy in Queens, Victor Lavelle idolized early 20th century horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. But as he grew older, he found the writer's racist attitudes disturbing.
What did he just say? And it was the kind of thing that if you were walking down the street and somebody said that, you'd smack him in the mouth.
Lavelle's new novella, The Ballad of Black Tom, is a response to Lovecraft. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. St. Vincent's Healthcare is bringing its inaugural Medical Mission at Home to the First Coast this weekend. This day-long event will provide free basic healthcare services to anyone who needs them, regardless of whether they have health insurance. Joining us now with more about this event is Virginia Hall, System Director of Community Engagement at St. Vincent's. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also joining us is Tracy Loftus, Chief Mission Integration Officer. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
All right. So this event is this Saturday, March 5th. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. From 9 to 3 at the downtown campus of Florida State College at Jacksonville.
Okay. And what do people need to know if they're thinking about coming?
They just need to come.
it's open for anybody in our community that needs access to health care. And of course, our focus is reaching those that are underinsured or the uninsured in our community. But we want to make sure that everyone that comes through our doors that day connects with a provider in our community so that they can continue good care after Saturday.
Okay. And so this is the first time such an event is happening. How did this all come about?
So this is part of our Ascension Ministry, which is a national ministry, and our St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville has been doing this for about 20 years, and we've decided to adopt this type of care here in Jacksonville. And basically, this is a medical mission trip, but right here at home. Mm-hmm. And so it was well-timed with our 100-year celebration. We're celebrating 100 years in the Jacksonville ministry, and it's just part of who we are with our mission. It allows us to go out into the community outside of our walls and find those that need our help the most.
Do we have any idea what kind of need is out there for medical care?
There is a great need out there. Jacksonville has more than 3,000 homeless people who don't have access to health care. So we do think that's a population who we will see on Saturday. Mm. But there's also a great deal of people who maybe have insurance, but they have high deductibles, or they work during the week and can't access medical care mm-hmm. during that time frame. So we think we'll see a lot of those type of individuals also.
And I understand there will be a lot of volunteers working at the event. Who will be out there?
Yes, we have more than 400 volunteers who will be on site that day. We have some great community partners that we're going to have on site who will be offering information on social services available in the community. So we really think that there's going to be lots of things, because in addition to the medical care and testing, we will have vision and hearing screenings, we'll have behavioral health consultation, wellness and financial information, and spiritual care, which is an important part of this event.
Okay, so these are services that some people may not have received in a very long time, if ever. And what happens after this event?
So after this event, part of the goal is for this not to be a health fair. We really want this to be more. We want to make sure that anybody that we connect with in the community is able to be connected to a medical home or a clinic in our community so that after Saturday, they have a place to go and follow up care. We're not looking to just be there for a day. We want to be there for them throughout the year.
And who are some of the partners who will be speaking with people?
We have Jack's Area Legal Aid, Real Sense, Tobacco Free Jacksonville, Kids Care. We have the Health Planning Council, who's going to be, although the registration currently is closed for the Affordable Care Act, they have information on when it opens back up, what you need to then follow through and apply later on. Those are just a few of the many vendors we have coming.
Okay. And again, tell us where this is and what times and what people need to know.
All right. So we hope everybody will join us on this Saturday, March 5th, from 9 to 3 at the downtown campus of the Florida State College of Jacksonville. They just need to come and ask for the help, and we will be there for them.
All right. And that's basic medical care, testing, behavioral health consultations, consultations about maybe skin cancer, vision and hearing screenings, wellness and financial information will be available, social services and spiritual care, all available from St. Vincent's Healthcare at the Medical Mission at Home event this Saturday from 9 to 3. Thank you again to Virginia Hall, System Director of Community Engagement, and to Tracy Loftus, Chief Mission Integration Officer, both with St. Vincent's Healthcare. Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you, Jessica.
And coming up after this break, First Coast Success profiles Mellow Mushroom and Burrito Gallery owner John Valentino. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Day of reckoning, depending on how you spell wreck. Voters in 11 states on Tuesday answer these questions. Can Cruz hold his home state of Texas? Will Rubio's boat float in Florida? Will Trump sink in Boston Harbor? Where can Bernie win? How can Hillary lose? Politics coming up all this week on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
The Atlantic Center for the Arts brings together diverse groups of composers, writers, choreographers, and visual artists to collaborate in a natural setting. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the Atlantic Center for the Arts in New Smyrna Beach, the Seminole War Journal of J.W. Phelps, and Mosquito Control. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation. He's the man behind some of the First Coast's most popular restaurants, including Mellow Mushroom, Burrito Gallery, and Uptown Kitchen and Bar. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Mathis of the Daily Record profiles entrepreneur John Valentino.
It was 14 years ago that John Valentino opened his first restaurant in Jacksonville. That was a Mellow Mushroom Pizza Baker's along Southside Boulevard in what's known as the Tinseltown area. He followed that with more Mellow Mushroom franchises in Fleming Island, Jacksonville Beach, River City Marketplace, and Avondale. That wasn't all. Since 2014, he has been a partner and CEO of the Gallery Restaurant Group, which owns the city's two burrito galleries in downtown and Riverside, as well as the Uptown Kitchen and Bar in Springfield. And last summer, he bought the French Pantry in Southside. He plans to expand the concepts. John Valentino, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you for having me.
Why the restaurant industry? You returned to Jacksonville in sales. What were you selling, and how did that turn into restaurants?
Well, first, what I was selling was valves. Really exciting stuff. No, I focused on the territory in Southwest Georgia and North Florida. My primary places that I traveled to were Palatka and Fernandina Beach, paper mills, power plants, etc. And I was more or less being groomed to go back to Atlanta and take over that business. And I decided, after looking at the landscape in Jacksonville and what restaurants were out there in the early 2000, that I would try and do a Mellow Mushroom in Jacksonville.
Why Mellow Mushroom?
I was always intrigued by the nature and novelty of the concept. You know, it's three guys, one graduated from Georgia Tech and two from University of Georgia, and they decided not to go to work and instead open a restaurant. And that started all the way back in 1974. And, you know, it's a really neat story.
Let's talk about the Mellow Mushroom in Avondale. I think a lot of people probably remember the situation where you created that restaurant in Avondale, and you ran into some community opposition in the historic district as you opened there, but it all worked out, and you've won many awards for the historic aspect of that restaurant. What lessons did you learn from that?
I would say that's probably one of the more important both life and business lessons that I've learned. I never thought that by purchasing a piece of property that was standing there with a closed gas station less than a mile from my house and wanting to open a family-friendly restaurant primarily serving pizza was going to be such a controversy. It was a long process. It was a two-year process. I'll never forget, we were going to go to hold a community meeting, and I'm driving down St. John's Avenue, and there are signs posted saying, come to the community meeting, you know, for Mellow Mushroom. And it was going to be in a chapel. And when there were so many people there, we had to go to the full church, and it was standing room only, and I think it was 250 or so people. So I'm standing on the stage in front of many people that I know, whether it be friends or neighbors or parents of children that are in my children's classes. And it was quite an experience. I think that going through it and what ultimately happened as a part of the design and final product was very good. But the process of fighting with neighbors and fighting the online fight and all of that was very unfortunate.
Let's move a little bit in town now to the French Pantry. That has a very interesting story in Jacksonville. Tell us a little bit about that and how you became involved in that.
Somebody sent me a text not long ago of the top 10 tourist spots in the state of Florida. And there was no other restaurants on there other than the French Pantry. And it definitely is a culinary tourist location. I had not actually patronized the French Pantry until probably 2010. And it wasn't long after that that I approached Chef Tim and said, I own these Mellow Mushroom restaurants in town, and I wondered if you could possibly make some bread for me. And so we worked together to create a recipe, and since that time, we kind of established a good relationship. And it was February, I was talking with him before they opened, and he says to me, you know, when are you going to open one of these? And I looked at him, and I really didn't know what to say at first. And I just said, I'm so busy right now. I really don't have time to do anything else. And then I think it was later on that evening at about 3 a.m, I said to myself, you need to go over there and talk to him and see what he is interested in. And so we did. And basically, he and his wife, you know, they're getting older, and they kind of needed an exit strategy. And I was flattered that they had thought of me to carry on their legacy. It's certainly feasible that they could have sold that restaurant to many, many people. But it all worked out. In July, we closed on the business, and they planned to work there for another 4+ years. They're very hardworking people. And currently, I am working on a pretty high profile location on the west side of Jacksonville. And my plan is to open a more of a retail operation, do a lunch and a dinner, and then possibly some brunch on the weekends. Chef Tim is an amazing chef, and he has a lot of recipes that he does not feature at lunch on Powers Avenue. And I definitely want to share his passion for food with some of Jacksonville.
So you now have restaurants just throughout the area, mm-hmm. with different concepts. How do you see Jacksonville as a restaurant town or city?
As a restaurant city, well, in 2000, before I did Mellow, it was really not. There was really nothing but chains. There was Biscotti's, BB's, Dolphin Depot at the beach. There were just very few good quality places to eat. And in the last 4 years, it is, I would say, probably one of the fastest growing industries, especially from a retail standpoint. All the different restaurants and bar concepts or local beer concepts, tap rooms that have opened. I think it's very rewarding to have been a part of, you know, that process. The economic development of Jacksonville is very, very important to me. And having gone through the experience in Avondale, even more so.
What are your specific secrets to success in the industry?
I think given my 10 years in sales, you know, you have to get up every morning and organize yourself and run your own business. And one of my mantras is to always make it better. And you may not accomplish that every day, but if you devote a lot of brain power to that, you can make that happen. And in order to make it better, you have to be aware of what's going on. And in the restaurant world, that is especially true. You know, you have to be able to walk into the restaurant on a busy Friday night and spend time in there and understand what's going right and what's going wrong. And what's going wrong is the awareness part, and the making it better part is how can I make that process better? And again, that's one of the things that I like most about the industry. It's very challenging.
Well, John Valentino, restaurant owner and executive, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you can read excerpts from Karen Mathis's interview with John Valentino in today's edition of The Daily Record. After a quick break, March Madness hits Jacksonville tomorrow. That and lots more sports ahead with Cole Pepper.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Two giant chemical companies merge, but who's responsible for what's left behind?
Everybody has kind of considered the DuPont to Dow acquisitions to be a way of either escaping from the corporate responsibility or reinforcing themselves for the liabilities that are out there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. When big business gets very personal, that's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Joining us now with a look at this week's sports is our own sports analyst, Cole Pepper.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Morning, Cole.
Good morning, Jessica. I have to tell you that March is one of my favorite months for a number of reasons, not the least of which being that March Madness comes. And as a big college basketball fan, a guy who went to the University of Kansas, which has a great college basketball tradition, it's been great to see both UNF and JU really take their games up to the next level. Of course, last year UNF made the run into the NCAA basketball tournament, into the Big Dance, and this year UNF and JU were two of the top teams in their conferences. And starting tomorrow, they will be hosting games in the Atlantic Sun Conference tournament. So this is significant because, of course, home court advantage always seems to help. JU lost only twice all year at home this year. Once was to UNF by 1 point on Thursday night. And both teams, I think, have a good chance of winning the tournament. The winner of this tournament gets a spot in the Big Dance. And how great would it be for Jacksonville once again to be represented? It had been a long time before last year, since Jacksonville had been represented as the city in the NCAA basketball tournament. And now they get a chance to. So tomorrow night, at Swisher Gymnasium on the JU campus, the Dolphins host Lipscomb, and at UNF, it will be the Spartans of South Carolina Upstate coming to town. And if they can win, JU and UNF could wind up potentially meeting again in the tournament, and that would be, it would trump the biggest game in history of that series, which was last Thursday when it went down to the wire in a one-point game. So very exciting time of the year as far as college basketball is concerned, and the fact that whether you're a JU alum or a UNF alum or just rooting for the city of Jacksonville to have some representation in that office pool, it's a great time to be following it.
Will we find out this week whether those teams are going to the tournament?
By the end of the week, we'll know the winner will go because there's not going to be an at-large team taken from the Atlantic Sun Conference tournament. Only one team is going to the Big Dance, and the winner of this tournament will be going, Selection Sunday is not till a week from Sunday, so we won't know the full field until then, but we'll know if JU or UNF are going to be in it.
All right, looking good for Jacksonville.
No doubt about it. We also had a lot of high profile in terms of on the field with soccer on Saturday. New York Red Bulls were in town, last year's best record in the MLS and a terrific team, highest scoring team in the MLS, and they put it to the Armada 5-1 in a game that could have been 5-3 or 5-4 if not for the Red Bulls goalkeeper, Luis Robles, who was just terrific. The irony here is that Robles was once tutored by now Armada head coach Tony Meola.
Oh, no.
So he's kind of his own creation, created this guy who's now become one of the best goalkeepers in the MLS. But it was a great atmosphere, a lot of families with kids out there, and of course the crazy supporter section 904 was on hand as well at the baseball grounds. This now creates the next month for the Armada where they're going to be playing teams in their own league, NASL, in preseason games.
Mm-hmm.
USL, the league below, or college teams. They played UNF last month, and now they'll play here against JU and against Flagler over the course of the next 5 weeks before their season starts. So kind of a chance to ramp up against some competition that might not be nearly as tough as the New York Red Bulls the rest of the way.
All right, and going over to the Jags.
The NFL Combine wrapping up in Indianapolis. You know, the Jaguars clearly need to address the defense here in the offseason, whether that's through free agency or whether that's through the draft. One of the disappointing things to see, and it's always tough to find a pass rusher in the draft who's going to make an immediate impact. It happens occasionally, but not very often. The two areas the Jaguars really need to address are pass rusher and safety. And it's looking more and more like the best bet for the Jaguars is if Jalen Ramsey, the Florida State safety and cornerback, would fall to them at their pick in the draft. which could happen. A lot of people are looking at, hey, can they find somebody like Joey Bosa, who is one of the top defensive ends in college football. Didn't run a great 40 yesterday, not really an explosive player, and you wonder how that's going to impact things. The big hope for the Jaguars is they can find a player or two in free agency who can help them as far as a pass rusher, a veteran player. It means they're probably going to have to spend some money. That's the downside. The plus side is they haven't spent the money all that much of late, so they have almost $30 million under the salary cap that they must spend in order to get to a league floor that's demanded part of the collective bargaining agreement. So they're going to spend some money in free agency somewhere along the line. And if they can get some pass rushers, that's going to go so far to helping that defense. The offense looks like it's well on the way with Blake Bortles and the young wide receivers, but they need to get that defense better. And this is such an important year for Gus Bradley and Dave Caldwell and company. If the Jaguars don't at least contend for the playoffs seriously this year and maybe make the playoffs, I think Gus Bradley's done.
And just a quick mention here, some ladies' hoops is in town this week.
The SEC women's basketball tournament comes to town. And so one of the things that the city has done a great job of is bringing these events. We talked about the curling national championships that came. And so not necessarily, you know, the economic impact doesn't just come from things like having the NCAA tournament or the Florida-Georgia game. Think about the all the teams in the SEC who are coming here, and the fans and the families and so forth who will come, and that makes some you know, some economic impact in the city. So we'll be interested to see how that is done. The city always does a great job of running those events. Listen, if you can run the NCAA basketball tournament here, you can handle the SEC tournament from an operational standpoint. It's all about the experience that the folks have when they come here.
And that's at Veterans Arena this week. Cole, thank you so much for being here. You can follow Cole Pepper on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that is our program. Thank you to all of our guests and callers this morning. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed any portion of today's show, subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also watch clips from the show at our partner TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, what the South Carolina Democratic primary results tell us about the campaigns and what's ahead going into the Super Tuesday primaries. That's up next. I'm Jessica Palumbo. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.